on this episode of Mac Break Weekly. I am filling in for Leo Laporte. I've got Jason Snell, Andy Anatko, and Renee Ritchie joining me. We're going to talk about some iOS 8 debacles, Retina IMAX coming, all sorts of interesting rumors on the Apple horizon. Lots to talk about, all coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is a Mac Break Weekly, episode 422, recorded Tuesday, September 30th, 2014. Designed by Agle. This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is the best way to buy and manage domain names. It's simple, honest, and easy to use. For 10% off your first purchase, go to Hover.com and enter the promo code MBW9. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code MacBreak. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting caspersleep.com/MacBreak and enter the promo code MacBreak. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Mac Break Weekly. This is episode 422. I am Sarah Lane, filling in for Mr. Leo Laporte, who is on vacation in London this week. In fact, I've been breathlessly watching all of his photos come in from the London Eye and Claridge's, and he's eating lots of porridge and stuff like that. But anyway, thanks, everybody, for being with us. I am not alone here in studio. I actually have Jason Snell sitting to my right.
Hello.
Hello, Jason. Would you say you are spending most of your time writing for sixcolors.com these days?
I am writing for sixcolors.com, my website. And then I'm doing a tech podcast called Upgrade, which is on Relay FM.
You know, before the show, you mentioned to me that it is apparently National Podcasters Day or Podcast Day.
Nobody told us.
I had no idea. I feel like this is something that really should be more in my wheelhouse anyway, doing this for a living. So
I didn't get you a card or anything.
I didn't get you anything either.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We'll just agree to do this next year.
It's the thought that counts, right?
Exactly.
Over on my left is Andy Anatko, tech columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and one of the hosts of Mac Break Weekly. Hey, Andy.
Hello. Gosh, to be in London in September.
Right. It's so rainy and cold. You feel it in your bones. Actually, I don't really know anything about the weather in London in
rainy's
September.
Rainy is usually a good guess for any
isn't that sort of it's like a year-round type of a situation. But you're having a good time.
Your hat will be well washed by the time you reboard your plane at Virgin Atlantic. That's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks for being here, Andy. And of course, Renee Ritchie, editor at iMore. You are the editor, right? You're editor, writer. You pretty much do everything. You're a podcaster as well.
Yep. Thanks. How's it going, Sarah?
Thanks for being here, Renee. It's going really well, thanks.
Winter is coming here, Sarah. The trees are turning shades of golden red dragons, and smarter creatures than me are leaving for the South.
Is that so? Do Canadians talk like that usually? That's very poetic of you.
Is it? I don't know. Well, it's very cold, Sarah. We have a lot of time to think in poetic sentences.
Right. To put together something that makes it all sound very beautiful. Well, thanks, everybody, for allowing me to be part of Mac Break Weekly. I always love the show because I sort of live and breathe everything that Apple makes anyway. So it's always a good time when I get to be part of the team. And it's nice to see Jason in person. That doesn't happen very often.
No, we usually are on like Skype or something.
Right, so yeah. Internet friends. Yeah, usually there's a little bit more.
The Twitter.
Yeah. A few pipes and screens between us. All right, so this is not going to be hard to fill a couple of hours because we have so much material to start with. I guess we can start with this 9-to-5 Mac story that Apple is changing things up a little bit with future versions of iOS 8. Of course, iOS 8 came out, 2 weeks ago now? Almost 2 weeks ago. It was two Wednesdays ago. Then we had the bit of the iOS 8.0.1 debacle, which was quickly fixed by Apple. I don't think anyone's having too many problems anymore with the version that actually does not brick Touch ID and your cellular service, which is something that in general people with iPhones would like. But that we might be rolling out on a little bit of a different schedule for future versions of iOS. That would be 8.1, 8.2, and 8.3 in staggered rollouts through 2015. Does that surprise everybody? At this point, I feel like nothing that Apple does surprises me anymore because it's kind of a different company that is doing things differently.
It's a return to form. In the early days of iOS, you always got the 0.1 version when the iPod Touches came out in the fall, and then you'd get a 0.2 and a 0.3. It was only, I forget it was iOS 5 or iOS 6, but they slowed down the point versions then. So this is more of a return to the original program than anything.
Yeah, you've got to wonder if there's a... Is this attached to hardware or is this a different change in philosophy? If it's attached to hardware, you know, you set up 8.1 for the new iPads that we're presumably going to get. Maybe 8.2 is connectivity with the Apple Watch. But I like the idea that maybe this is Apple shifting to a little bit different cadence for their OS updates. I think what we've seen, and maybe 8.01 was an example of it, maybe not, is that, you know, I think Apple has gotten really great at rolling their hardware out and that the software maybe has been struggling with their old processes to keep up with it. And I kind of like this idea of biting OS updates off in smaller chunks and rolling them out over time rather than dropping everything once a year.
Yeah, and also we've all seen so many examples of Apple really being chasing their own tails on this treadmill of having to make the release by September for the new iPhones or trying to make this new on some arbitrary deadline. It would be nice if they simply said that we're going to have the 0.1 releases ready when they're ready, and if we don't have to push it out the door on an arbitrary schedule, we're going to be able to do that. And also I think it points to how many different services that Apple is rolling out over the next couple of years. They're really broadening out into services and markets that they haven't really spent much time messing around with. And so if they have to wait for to tag something to a hardware release or to an annual release schedule, they're not going to be able to roll out things like an expansion of the payment system or take advantage of new entertainment features that might be in the new Apple TV and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know, you make a good point, Jason. The iPad situation, that makes sense that you might want to tie iOS 8, future versions of iOS 8 rollouts with obviously products that can be updated. But then again, we know that the Apple Watch is not going to be running iOS.
But it has to talk to the phone.
Sure, yeah. It's some modified version of something that, yes, has to be compatible in some way. But yeah, we've got all these product categories. I mean, the Apple Watch, I guess we could talk about that. Nobody exactly knows when that is happening. There's a story that I read on Mac Rumors that said Apple will be lucky to ship the Apple Watch even by Valentine's Day. I don't know what the significance of Valentine's Day
so
would be.
Lucky.
Yeah, exactly.
It's code that it's actually going to be the luck of the Irish, and it's going to ship on St. Patrick's Day. It's secret Apple code.
See, that would be really cool. Yeah, a green Apple Watch. I guess I. Besides the fact that I suppose you are buying and giving gifts that are Valentine's Day related, I'm not exactly sure what the February significance would be. Yeah. Besides the fact that
that's
just
someone willing to buy me a rose gold watch really fast, then
it could be just as easy as whoever wrote that comment really really swung and missed on the last gift they did for their significant other on Valentine's Day, and now the only thing they can think about is what they have to get ready for Valentine's Day. So if they're going to pick out a date in the late winter, early spring, it's going to be that.
I guess we have to assume that Apple really, really wanted to be able to not just introduce the Apple Watch at their iPhone event earlier this month, but have it ready to ship for the holidays.
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think so either.
This is Apple's pattern. These brand new Apple products end up being supply constrained because they're really hard to build. And so Apple's pattern with them generally has been to release them after the holidays are over so that they can sell them, you know, as many as they can make, and by the next holiday season they'll be up to full speed on it. And I think that's the approach here, is that they wanted to give the rumors were all out there. They wanted to get that announcement out the door before they have to go through regulatory things and anything like that and control that. And now everybody's gonna, like us right now, we're gonna be talking about it for all this time, and then sometime next year they'll ship it and it'll probably trickle out. And I think they would have been completely not been able to fulfill need if they had made it available for the holidays.
Two thoughts I had on that was I was one of the reasons why I was thinking that Apple's going to do something simpler like a fitness band was because they certainly would love to take advantage of the holiday season. I'd see no indication they're ready to ship something as complicated as what they actually showed. So I was figuring, how about something simple that they have the capacity to make, that they can make at a good price point, and that people would absolutely want to get as gifts. But the second thing is that the more I think about it, the more I think that there are a lot of signs that the Apple Watch is still in its early stages, that we're not looking at something that is finished, and now they just need to get the regulatory approval, and now they need to get the partners in line and get the developers in line. I think that it's earlier than we might think, the stuff that Apple showed off at the event a few weeks ago is what they showed that was actually functioning and working, as opposed to the stuff that they're still scrambling to get actually finished and approved.
Well, I tapped on something on the – I mean, we were all there. They put the phone, the watch on our wrist, and then they had another one that was functional. The one on our wrist was just running a demo. And I remember I tapped on one of the icons on the screen, and the guy looked like he was going to freak out because he was like, no, you're not supposed to tap on it. Only we're supposed to tap on it. And that was clearly like there were things that they had in the script.
Like Nigel Tufnel showing off his guitar collection. No, David Point, Addy. Just look, don't look.
Don't even look at it. And it reminded me of the original iPhone, where I tapped on some of the icons on the original iPhone the day they announced it, and it was screenshots. It was like, this app will go here later.
Well, so what does it matter if you tap on anything if it's just a demo anyway?
I think with this, it's that there are things that are going to crash the phone or that they don't want to show, and that there were things that were working that they wanted to show, and that having us touch the device was not part of the script. So I felt really bad for the guy because, I mean, I was like looking around to see if his minder was going to come and sweep in and take him away. It's not ready. It's totally not ready.
That's the same experience. Yeah. It was like there was, you could see like the invisible force field that the demonstrators were erecting between you and the watch, that if you made a sudden movement towards something or if you did something that they weren't really planning for you to do, you could just see the geek. Okay, that's fine. And that happened like twice with a couple of different demonstrators that I was working with. I'm like, I knew that this was not a place to stress test anything or see if anything was working because it was the nature of the event. They weren't showing off a finished object, so I don't think it would have been appropriate. But you could tell that they were like, oh God, this guy has hairy wrists. It overheats and explodes if it's put on a hairy wrist. Get him to shave. Abort.
I wasn't trying to crash it or anything. I was just trying to see if those icons looked really small. I wanted to see how easy they were to tap and if I would mistap. And it worked. The thing I tapped on opened, and then he turned pale and ran
away. Now you know why engineers disconnect interface before handing those things over for demos.
Yeah, but Andy's larger point totally remains, which is this is a product that is going to take some time before it's ready. They're not just stalling because of production line. They're fixing it out. This is why they didn't mention the battery life other than to say, at the end of the day, you can charge it. Because I think they don't know the battery life because it's not, the software's not done.
I think that goes back to Jason's earlier point too, because we just had iOS 8.1 seeded to developers yesterday, and it's got hooks buried in it for the Apple Pay system. So, you know, that'll come out. It'll enable Apple Pay. You'll have Touch ID on the iPads that it'll enable as well. And then as we move through the year, they'll have the version that enables the watch and maybe that works with the new Apple TV. And then they might have a version later in the year as we start setting up for iOS 9. But it really is what's the best way to put it? It is a marathon composed of sprints. Like they literally sprint towards release day every September. And then they have very little time because they're already working on iOS 9. They're going back and fixing iOS 8 bugs. And it is a grueling cycle. And I think breaking it up like this, and especially with the watch coming at them, and you have to imagine they took a lot of people off other projects to move to the watch project, and they have to fill both that team up and the previous teams up, that it's going to be a good juggling act come the spring.
Yeah, somebody in our chat room a couple minutes ago makes a good point that I think is really going to mirror what a lot of other consumers think is, okay, when the first iPhone was released, it was expensive, it was different, but it was something that, hey, you need a phone. So this might just be a new, exciting, expensive version of the phone that you already had. And it's a brave new world, and it worked out really well for Apple. The watch thing, a lot of us are still kind of scratching our heads about. Well, I certainly don't need one because I already have a phone that tells me what time it is. So then it turns into something where it's like, is it comfortable? Does it look cool? Base price is $350, and we're all sort of agreeing that, yeah, you know, the first version of this watch might not be perfect, you know, as much as the iPhone wasn't as well. But it's that product category that's elective rather than, oh, I need this.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is you can never see the...
Go ahead, Renee. I'll go after you.
I was going to say, you could never see the future in advance. It always looks, you know, misty and foggy. But when you get it, Apple doesn't really make these different devices. They package them that way, but they make small, increasingly small computers that connect you with a bunch of things. And a watch now is a luxury, but we have a phone, not because we really need a phone. We have a phone because we need to stay connected. And whether Apple can move enough connectivity to the watch, enough control, enough authentication, enough logging to the watch to make it better in certain situations than the phone is, that'll be the real story. We can tell time on our phone, but it's the best way to tell the time. If they can make a really good argument that it's more convenient to do these things on something small on your wrist, then a lot of people who, you know, sure, watch people probably have their Rolex and their Panerais or whatever. But there might be a lot of people who say, I can leave my phone in the pocket. I can get a bigger phone and leave it in my purse. I can maybe issue a phone and just have a tablet. And there'll be a whole bunch of new use cases that I think we'll only figure out over the next year.
Yeah. When I wrote my piece from the night after the event, that was my lead paragraph, that I don't think that Apple has ever made a product like this before, where there is no preceding successful product that they could then put their own exclamation point at the end of that sentence. Maybe even have to go all the way back to the Apple II Plus, because there weren't really home computers before until they basically, there wasn't an example of a successful home computer, and then they built one. With the Macintosh, they're already desktop computers, not something as good with the GUI. Even the iPod, we've got the Discman, we've got the Walkman portable music players. So people we're already seeded with all that information about, here's the sort of role in your life this is going to play. I can't remember even the iPad, I think, didn't have that place where we know you've never owned something like this. You don't know somebody who owns something like this right now, but we're going to convince you that this is something that you want and need, which is, I think, is an unusual place for Apple to be.
Well, how about the rumor, speaking of rumors, because there are always lots of rumors surrounding Apple products, that we're going to see a new Mac Mini update when we possibly get the new iPad announcement, which is obviously not official yet, but October 21st seems to be the going date for everybody, if that indeed was going to happen. New Mac Mini hasn't been refreshed in, what, 2 years? Almost 2 years?
Year and a half.
Forever, Sarah.
Yeah,
forever.
Forever.
Anything after 1.5 years is basically forever. I agree with you. I've never had a Mac Mini myself. I know that there are Mac Mini loyalists. A lot of them like to use it for their media management connected to televisions.
Podcasting?
Few friends of mine yep. have got Mac Minis in their kitchen with a little monitor.
Wow.
It seems to be the computer that if you've got one, you think, oh, yeah, this is really, really helpful. But again, it's not necessarily the computer that I've ever needed.
Well, I have two in my house.
Okay.
So I definitely am a Mac Mini fan, and it has been sad that it hasn't been updated. It's definitely not for everybody, but it's actually, if you don't want to buy an iMac, if you don't want to get an iMac with the screen and the whole thing, and you just want a computer to attach to an external display.
Yeah.
Your choices are Mac Mini or Mac Pro, unless or buy a laptop. But I mean, there is a place for it. I've got one behind my TV. It is attached to a bunch of storage, and it's where I put all my music and movies and stuff. And then the old one of that is in my son's room, and he uses it to play Minecraft. And they're great. And in fact, I want to buy one because I have a MacBook Air that I use attached to a monitor at my desk. And I actually realized that a nice Mac Mini, would have more power. And I actually would like to park one there. So I'm looking forward to it if they do update it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really important product because we've just been discussing about it for 30 seconds to a minute. And we've talked about at least five different unique use cases for it. People who want to use it just as a media server, people who want a spare computer in a certain room or another, people that I almost all the time when you go into someone's server room, you will see these racks and racks of Blade servers, but there's always one Mac Mini I find somewhere in that stack because that's what the admin wants to use to administrate all that hardware. I'm using one for podcasting right now. It's also the cheapest point of entry into macOS, given that so many people will have something that they can plug a VGA cable into, and you can get, you know, God, if trash day is Tuesday morning, Monday night at 10 p.m., you can have as many mice and keyboards as you want. So there's no less expensive way to get into Mac than a Mac Mini. So it's kind of disappointing. It'd be disappointing if Apple were to give up on it, and that's the exact reason why I don't think they are giving up on it.
How do you think Apple feels about, Jason, as you described, it's great for media management, music, movies, that sort of thing. That kind of competes with Apple TV itself.
Well, it does, and it's not for everybody, but this is like the Mac Mini seems to be a product with a whole bunch of little niche uses. So this is why it hasn't been updated in 2 years. It's not a high priority for Apple, but I think it's nice to have around. And, you know, Apple kept the iPod Classic around for ages when it was sort of like very few uses were left mm-hmm. for it. And the Mac Mini has a lot of uses, not every product that Apple makes has to be a super mainstream product. And I think that's where the Mac Mini is. It fills in, it gives them flexibility in the Mac product line rather than just saying, okay, you got to buy a laptop, an iMac, or a Mac Pro. It gives them another product. It's the lowest priced Mac. There are lots of reasons why keeping it around is great, but I wouldn't ever argue that it should be Apple's focus, and it clearly isn't Apple's focus. That's why it hasn't been updated since 2012, I think.
Yes. All right. Well, then the next question becomes, okay, so what does get refreshed exactly if we don't have Intel Broadwell processors that are available
or do we?
Yeah. I mean, the last I heard, this is not happening until 2015 because it's been, they've been delayed for a variety of reasons, but you figure, well, there's really no point in being like new Mac Minis with Haswell processors that aren't impressive to anybody anymore.
Retina MacBook Air, as far as I understood, was at least the recent version, was always built on Broadwell, and it was just Broadwell delays that was keeping it from market. And as we saw with the original MacBook Air and other things, Apple has been good at getting chipsets as fast as Intel can make them, often ahead of other manufacturers. And if they could do that again with a Retina MacBook Air, that would be terrific. If Intel is really delaying them and that goes in 2015, then that's really sad because they have a lot of, like, you know, there's rumors of 4K or 5K iMacs or Retina iMacs as well. And a lot of that hinges on all the technology that has to go to support that many pixels at, you know, on a MacBook Air at that, you know, small size and with that good battery life, on an iMac just driving all those pixels. People complain that Apple is too controlling, but it's often the parts of the chain that they don't control that ends up causing a little bit of dissatisfaction.
If ever there was a Mac that Apple would release with the about-to-be-eclipsed Intel processor family, it's the Mac Mini. So it wouldn't shock me. It would be kind of sad, but it wouldn't shock me if they said, yeah, well, we updated the Mac Mini. Here it is. And it was just using Haswell, yeah. Wouldn't shock me. It would be sad.
What if they were accompanying it by a $100 price drop? Would that soften the blow a little bit?
Yeah, I mean... I don't know what Apple's thinking for this product, right? I mean, when it first came out, it was $499, which was amazing. And then the next year, they sort of stepped away and said, nah, $599, let's try that. But there's room in there. It would be interesting to see. I think Apple knows exactly who's using this product, I think, and what they're using it for. And they may just decide, look, you know, this is it's going to be better than the existing chips that are in there because it's 2 years old. And
it never went Haswell.
Have this.
It's interesting to think what Broadwell has a lot of advantages for a Retina MacBook Air. What their advantages are for a Mac Mini is harder to determine.
Well, I think in a few minutes we should probably start talking about bendy phones because I know you're all ready to do that. But first, let's take a quick break to thank Hover.com for sponsoring this episode of Mac Break Weekly. If you've got a great idea for, you know, a website or a blog or whatever, you need a domain. Well, okay, where do you go? You want something catchy, you want a good memorable name, you want it to represent you in some way. That's what Hover is so good for. It gives you exactly what you need to get your domain, get it secured, and get on with whatever creative project you want to attach to it. You need that perfect domain. So right now is a great time to start a new project because Hover recently lowered prices on over 200 domain extensions, including many top-level domains. They also reduced the price for new .com domain names, now $12.99. Plus, Whois Privacy is included for free on every domain that supports it. People love Hover. Geeks love Hover. Developers love Hover. Designers, programmers. People love Hover because they know that they have good tools and they have good support. You don't have to be some sort of a tech expert to get a domain. It's very, very easy to use Hover. Search a few keywords. Hover will show you the best available options. Yeah, maybe you got an idea for a domain. Hey, let's see if it's available. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it is, but maybe it isn't. Maybe there's something similar that Hover could suggest to you and you go, oh yeah, okay. All right. What are you doing, Chad? You looking for my name? Let's see what Hover wants. SarahLane.com isn't available because I own it, but hey, we've got some other stuff. SarahLane.biz. What I'm missing out. SarahLane.today. That's kind of fun. SarahLane.global. It's a little bit weird. SarahLane.pro. Yeah. And the list goes on, obviously. That would be a really weird domain for you to have, but it'd be kind of fun for me to have. Hover also offers valet transfer service. You might be using another domain registrar. Lots of people are. You switch over to Hover, and it's a painless process. For free, Hover takes care of the entire process for you and lets you know when your domains are nice and settled in your Hover account. They also transfer all your DNS settings. I have sometimes been in DNS hell here or there because you make one little wrong move and then it's very confusing. Hover does all that for you. No matter how many domain names you have, it's no additional cost. Best customer service support, no wait, no hold, no transfer phone service, and Hover also offers volume discounts. That means that they give you a discount on your domain renewals, which starts at 10 domains and then goes up in value from there. So they you know, kind of throw you a bone if you're actually managing a larger amount of domains, and some of us are. Visit Hover today to register your domain name and a little extra, 10% off your first purchase. HOVER.com, that's hover.com, and use the promo code MBW9. That stands for Mac Break Weekly 9. Promo code MBW9, and thanks so much to Hover for the support of Mac Break Weekly. I'm Sarah Lane, filling in for Leo Laporte here on Mac Break Weekly this week. Leo is off in London, but I am joined by, in person, Jason Snell. Of course, to my left, Andy Anatko, and then, of course, Renee Ritchie, sitting in America's hat up there. You guys must get so sick of us saying things like that.
No, you took Justin Bieber off our hands. We're good.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, he almost fits better in the U.S., which, absolutely. You're not... Yeah. What does that say about all of us? So I mentioned before the break, and thanks all of you gentlemen for joining me today. Before the break, I said we should probably talk about the whole bendy phone crisis, which apparently is a lot less of a crisis than perhaps Samsung would have us believe. Renee, your phone does not look bendy.
I have had this bended. In my non-hipster jeans for going on 14 days. I've sat down with it. I've run around with it. I've done everything I can humanly do with it. It is still straight.
This is a 6 or a 6 plus?
This is a 6 plus. I have a 6 in my other pocket.
Oh.
And that is also straight.
Now, when you say pockets and you say sitting, you're talking about front pockets or back pockets or...
Front pockets. I'm not an animal.
Well, see, I don't know. I have a 6 plus here, which if anybody watches my show i5, you know that I have a lot of buyer's remorse. Even though it was Leo's money, I still
you have Leo's buyer's remorse.
I still have remorse because it's too large for me. But I wouldn't dream of even trying to put it in a pocket because I don't have pockets that fit phones in general. Maybe a BlackBerry Pearl would fit in one of my front pockets, but nice, you know, we're not really doing that anymore. All right, Jason.
Yeah, I got the 6 here.
You got the 6, which is so significantly smaller than the 6 plus. It's unbelievable. Is it fitting comfortably in your pocket?
Oh, yeah.
You have it?
Yeah, I haven't noticed a difference, but it's not the 6 plus. I
mean,
I'm used to the 5S in my pocket, so it's not that different.
Does everybody carry phones in their pockets?
You have pockets.
I mean, I've got pockets. I've just never thought to shove a phone in.
So Ben Thompson, who does Stratechery, he lives in Taiwan, and I mentioned this on Twit actually a couple weeks ago. He says that we know that large phones are very big in Asia. This is that's the market where the Galaxy Notes have had the most success. And when I was talking to Apple about the 6 Plus, they definitely said there are certain regions that really love huge phones, and Asia is the biggest one. What Ben Thompson said is people who have these big phones generally do not put them in their pockets. They have a bag, and it lives in the bag, and then they take it out and use it, and then they put it back in the bag. There's also obviously some cultural stuff at work here, but I think that's an interesting thing that here in the U.S., especially being used to these smaller phones, because they sell better here, I think are used to putting them in our pockets. And big phones maybe don't work in pockets so well. I don't know.
Also, we're Americans. We got big pants for our big butts, so we got pockets that can hold that sort of stuff.
Pockets,
but yeah, I've been carrying around both of them pretty much daily. No bendy problems yet. That doesn't mean that I absolutely discount the experiences that some people have been having. The thing that I've been finding that little bit disappointing about some of the commentary is that every time there's someone says, yeah, well, I was carrying it in a pocket and looked at bent after a couple of days, the immediate response is, oh, see, it's just stupid people doing stupid things with their phones because they're idiots. Let's wait. I don't think it's an epidemic problem, or else we'd be seeing a lot more reports of it than this. But let's wait a few weeks until we see what happens. I do think that you have to make a deliberate choice for the 6 Plus. You really shouldn't just get it because it's bigger and it's fancier. Because even I'm in the habit of carrying my phone in my shirt pocket because it's easily accessible. And I spent a really wonderful day on Sunday walking around with both these phones, just 8 miles covering most of Boston, just taking pictures. And I had to make sure that I did not keep my 6 Plus in my shirt pocket because I it was a little bit shallow. And boy, you just put about 17 degrees of flex in my waist, and that thing is almost certainly going to be tumbling out because it's so top heavy off of this pocket. So, I mean, you're right, Sarah. I mean, it's going to be way too big for a lot of people. And it's a shame that some people might have just gone for their gut instinct for the larger phone when the iPhone 6 is plenty big. It's almost I almost consider it a perfect size if you don't have a fancy for a smaller sized phone. Enough extra screen real estate to make it worth the while, but small enough that you can really conceal it pretty well.
Yeah, I thought that the whole let's get the 6 Plus, even though it's ridiculous because I'm a pretty small person and I certainly don't have big hands, would be just a sort of a fun experiment, especially because as you guys were mentioning, there are certain markets where the larger phablet-sized phones, I don't know if phablet is a bad word on the show or not, but you know what I mean, do sell well. People like them. There are different accessories for carrying these phones. Maybe it's not so dependent on being in your pocket. Well, my phone was never in my pocket to begin with, so that part of it doesn't really bother me. I've got some sort of like a handbag or shoulder bag or something usually with me, but it's so comically large that I'm going to get used to it. I have gotten used to it over the last 10 days, but it's not getting any easier. I can never use it with one hand.
It's not as enjoyable as you hoped.
Can I ask you, have you were primarily an iOS user to begin with? You weren't using Android phones?
Never.
Okay, so I think
that's
might
part
be
of the issue.
That's part of it. I mean, if it's still too big, it's still too big. I think that the reason why 6 Plus can be really, really jarring for people who are moving up from an iPhone 5 is because they haven't had the chance, like me, to transition through. If I'd moved straight to this from an iPhone 4, this would have looked freaking huge. Whereas this looks like just, it's a little bit on the large side, but it's not huge. And so to go from this to a phablet sized phone, a 5.5 inch screen, the iPhone Plus still is pretty big. Big even for me, but it doesn't seem quite so shocking. But you're right. I mean, even there's I was taking lots and lots of pictures. That was the whole point of my taking that walk on Sunday. And even for me, it was, wow, there's so many times where, especially when you're just taking a casual shot, I've got a drink in my hand. I'm walking through Quincy Market. Now I really have to put that drink down because you've got a shot at one handing a camera like this, the 6 Plus. Yeah, that thing is going to go right onto those cobblestones and break into smithereens if you even try it. So I think a case is going to be absolutely important for the iPhone 6 Plus for everybody.
Yeah, I usually am anti-case because I just like to feel the phone the way that it is. And it's thinner that way. And for the first time, I think I'm a hazard. I'm a walking hazard because it's all about juggling now, you know? Can I reach my thumb over? Whoa, and that's the end of the phone. Yeah. I've also noticed, and this is probably... It says something about the fact that I take too many walks at night and I live in a somewhat dangerous neighborhood of San Francisco, but I find that I feel very conspicuous.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I've got my phone out and I'm doing something, not that the iPhone 5S, which was my last iPhone, was invisible by any means, but you could almost kind of, tuck it into if you just sort of think, I got to hide it for a second or dip it into a pocket for a minute. This doesn't go anywhere. I feel like it's sort of like, rob me.
You're holding a billboard.
Yes. Take my phone, my expensive phone.
Well, with that big battery, it's going to hurt a lot more when you throw it at someone's face.
That's right.
There's an upside.
There you go. Yes. It's a weakness and a weapon.
To go back to the bending thing for a second, because a lot of people made fun of it. A lot of people are really upset about it. A lot of people made fun of it. There's like this YouTube culture versus Apple blogger culture war going on about it. And it's a little silly to me because it shows that people have trouble holding two truths, can exist at the same time. Back with AntennaGate, there absolutely was a problem that if you were in a low signal area and you touched a certain part of the phone, you could detune the signal. You didn't have to touch that part of the phone. And once you understood the physics behind it, you were fine. But it took a little bit of education and time, and Apple adapted to it with the iPhone, Verizon iPhone 4 and the 4S. And this is similar. You have a very thin piece of aluminum. And it's very thin because Apple realized that it's not thin for thin's sake. A lot of people want it to be thicker. It's thin because it makes it lighter. In the same way with the iPad 2 and the iPad Air, bigger things, when they're lighter, are easier for human beings to use, to hold up for long periods of time.
Not necessarily.
But when you have this sort of this relationship here with the phone, there's the volume buttons and there's a bolt right before those volume buttons where the titanium and steel reinforcements stop. So if you apply pressure to that, the cutout area where the volume is and that bolt meet, you can buckle the structure. That's something that you can understand and, you know, pay attention to, be careful with. If it's something you think you'll do, put a case on. It's not the same as people just bending the phones for jokes on YouTube, which is horrible, or going into stores and bending it. But it's something that it exists because of physics, because you have an object that has certain structural areas. And again, for me, it's just you understand what the problem is, or understand what the physics are, and then take good care of the stuff that you bought. Yeah.
I think that was not an analogy that I 100% agree with, because AntennaGate was a real problem. I experienced that like day one. I literally had it out of the packaging that it had come in 20 minutes earlier, fired it up, had a SIM card in it, and I was watching. Wow, I had 4 bars before. Why is there now 1 bar?
Some people deny
Exactly. With I won't even call it bend gate, but the issue that some people are having with bending, I agree that it seems to be very quite isolated. It doesn't seem to be an epidemic. I don't believe that it's a design fault, but the only complicity, if that's even an appropriate word, that Apple has, is that I think that there are going to be a lot of people who, like Sarah, are having their first really, really big phone after years and years of having what are now a small phone by smartphone standards. And they're only guilty of doing what with their phones, the things that they always do with their phones, which is to take really good care of them and try to prevent them from getting damaged, unbeknownst to them, knowing that, well, a larger phone has different rules now and there are added risks that your smaller phone did not have. So I hope that this will die down. I was very first amused and then kind of saddened by the fact that after about 6 or 7 hours of walking around the city using my iPhone 6 Plus, and now they're still new enough and rare enough that, hey, is that the new iPhone 6? And 2 or 3 times I got asked, is it bending on you? And I said, no, it's not bending on me. It's perfectly fine. It's not made out of clay.
Bent as well. It just never got as much media attention. But you ask anybody who did any form of iPhone repairs at all, including Apple geniuses, and they would tell you they would get people coming in and around the volume area. Some people managed to bend the phone because physics.
Yeah, actually, Anthony Nielsen, who's one of our editors, I made a joke about bending iPhone 6s, and he pulled out his iPhone 5S and said, look, it's not bent in half, but you can see a small little ridge from, I guess, sitting on it for the last year or so. Apple says only 9 people actually have complained about this. I don't know exactly where you get that official number. Yeah. It must be a certain way that somebody sent in a complaint to Apple support. But Consumer Reports, of course, got on the bandwagon and did some testing. Is the iPhone 6 Plus, for example, any weaker than other competitors in that class of smartphone? Consumer Reports says, the iPhone 6 Plus, the more robust of the new iPhones in our testing, started to deform when we reached 90 pounds of force and came apart with 110 pounds of force. With those numbers, it slightly outperformed the HTC One, which is largely regarded as a sturdy, solid phone, as well as the smaller iPhone 6, yet underperformed some other smartphones, and goes on to mention the LG G3, the Samsung Galaxy Note 3. Now, what we're talking about, 90 pounds of force. You're not talking about like gingerly, like, oh, sorry, my phone was in my back pocket. Whoops. Okay, let me put it on the table.
Round butts hit flat phones, Sarah.
Yeah, I mean, that's not happening very often.
Exactly.
It just can't be.
For 10 million phones sold, of which we don't know how many are iPhone 6 Pluses, but I'm betting it's more than 9. that's a low number even for Apple to report, so I'm not worried.
Yeah. It's almost like saying, my phone fell in the toilet because it was in my back pocket because it was so small I forgot it was there. Thanks for nothing, Apple.
Well, like Andy said, I think it's worth us I love that Andy is counseling patients here, because over time and with more of these out there, we'll find out whether there is a, was there a manufacturing flaw? Is this just a weakness in every model? Is this common or not? And my guess is that if some phones do have this problem, Apple will probably have a policy and they'll replace them and they'll do something. But right now it seems like such a small case that unless you're really trying to get attention, you're not very likely to see a problem here. And then we'll just have to see how it goes. But I do think it's fair to say that in a few months we'll have a much better idea. The internet doesn't want to wait a few months for anything, but we will have a better idea whether this is a serious problem or just another kind of oddball thing that happens when a new iPhone comes out.
Every year, Jason, there's something.
There's always something.
There's always something.
Like my grandma. Grandma.
We mentioned it earlier in the show that there was a small window of iOS 8.0.1. I think it was pulled about an hour and a half after being pushed out.
It was 80 minutes. Yep.
It was 80 minutes.
I counted.
Good work. I had not installed the update, so I was unaffected, and I got to just sort of sit back with some popcorn and watch Twitter have a meltdown and then regroup. Yep. So that's always, it's always fun to be an outsider in those situations and think, I'm so glad I wasn't one of the first. How about all of you?
Affected? I was one of the first, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but that's sort of our jobs, right, to try this stuff. So I did it, and I think Renee and I had a whole back and forth on Twitter as we both updated and said, yep, cell service is gone, Touch ID is gone, and everybody else who had installed it started chiming in. And then it turned out very quickly that it was just the sixes that seemed to be affected. Fives didn't seem to be affected. And Renee, did we finally figure out that it was also only if you did it over the air?
Yeah, the binary was fine. It was only the bit differential file for if you did it on device, which is a crazy problem to have.
Yeah. Yeah. So that stunk. And it was interesting to watch how Apple rolls back a mistake like this, because they haven't really done this very often, if ever, that I can remember. The first thing they did, and this is actually very clever, the first thing they did is stop signing the update. And what that means is at the end, after you download it, your device, any of these Apple software updates, your device checks with the server to see if the signature matches, to basically so it can't be vulnerable to an attack where a fake software update is sent to you and that can take over your phone. And they will often turn off signing for older versions of the operating system so you can't roll back. So what they did is they turned off signing for this. So people would download the update, some of them in the process of downloading the update, and then it would say some weird error, like you're not on the internet. I got one that said like device is not authorized.
Oh boy.
And it was weird, but what it was really doing is saying, I'm not going to install this. So they did that first. And then about 10 minutes later, if you were on an 8.0 device and you checked for software update, it said, you've got the latest version. So they eventually rolled it all the way back. And then I think later the next day, they pushed out 8.02. So it was an interesting process of like, how long does it take Apple to stop the flow of software updates? And it was, I think, pretty impressive that it only took them about 80 minutes to shut it completely down.
But not without, I can imagine, just a lot of confusion from people who need 40, cellular service.
Apple said there were 40,000 people affected out of 10 million new iPhone 6s and iPhone 6 pluses, which by no means is trivial. And there were some people who said, I never use Touch ID and never make phone calls, so I didn't even notice. I managed to downgrade to iOS 8.0.0 and then reinstall it, then downgrade, then actually install the binary for iOS 8.1 and that 8.0.1, and that worked fine.
It was really, I agree, Jason. It was so impressive. I was away at meetings that afternoon, and it was out and then pulled by the time I was aware of it and was ready to start downloading it. Yeah. My backup theory is that maybe this is more genius Apple marketing, where they're trying to do now limited edition releases like Mondo Gallery prints, where it's only available if you download it for the next 80 minutes and only 40,000 people will get it. So if you have the 8.01 release, put that in a Ziploc bag phone and then put it on eBay, because it's going to be worth something someday.
I upgraded already.
I guess I can see someone saying, oh, I didn't have to make a phone call in those couple of hours.
Sure.
So what does it really matter? But the Touch ID.
That's what I noticed when I rebooted.
That in itself is a big deal because, you know, if you need to make a phone call during that hour, if your dad just had a stroke, that's a really bad scene.
Definitely.
And you had to roll back. You had to go to iTunes and download the iOS 8 install and then do an update in place using iTunes on the computer to fix it during that 1 day period, which is non-trivial for people who aren't very comfortable or don't even remember the age before iCloud when you had to do that all the time to update.
They'll do the next one on DVD or CD.
They'll mail you a
40 floppies. Get your Mac SE.
Are there people who prefer to not use Touch ID when given the option? I mean, it's one of the best things ever invented as far as I'm concerned, but I also hate, you know, typing in my password every time I want to install an app, for example.
I heard a lot of people right after the 5S came out say that they were turning it off. And the software, you know, they made some software tweaks to make it work better.
That's true.
But it works so great now. I never have a problem unless I've been, like, doing the dishes or something and my hands are wet.
Sometimes at the gym, if I'm sweaty enough, I'm like, oh, this isn't that.
But otherwise, it just works. And with iOS 8 now, you can unlock all sorts of other stuff, too, which makes it that much more valuable. Like, unlocking one password with my thumbprint is so great.
We had a big discussion about this on Vector yesterday because Jesse Char, formerly of Apple, formerly of Pacific Helm, said that her fingerprints just never read with it. For some reason, it just never works.
She's a replicant.
She might be. And George,
it's the Weyland-Yutani logo in the middle of the fingertip that's throwing it off, I'm betting.
She said that she never uses it because for her, it's a form of identification. And right now, with a passcode, you know, someone else can use your passcode, can use your phone, can send something. But if she ever sends somebody a nasty text, it's now got her fingerprint proves that she was the one who sent it. So for her, it's entirely a culpability argument.
Interesting.
Weird fingerprint issues.
Interesting.
I love Touch ID.
I love Touch ID, too, because I put a hard password on my phone then instead of a four-digit code.
There you go.
I never wanted to enter in a long password every single time I unlock. But now that I got Touch ID, I only have to do that when I reboot, and so it's great.
And even then, I would say, and that doesn't happen that often. You know, sometimes I run out of batteries because I'm not paying attention or something. But even then, it's always like... that's right. My phone restarted. Now I have to type in my password like some sort of a Luddite.
Stupid password.
Yeah.
There is a legal issue, though, because like, I believe in American law still, you can be compelled to use your fingerprint but not compelled to use a passcode, so to give up a passcode. Mm. So some people just strictly for legal reasons won't enable Touch ID.
And that's an interesting point because I actually read the justification behind that because your passcode is information that you know that you cannot be compelled to say. But the fingerprint is just a physical thing, and you don't have to actually tell anybody what it is. And so that's the legal position that they can't compel you to unlock something with a fingerprint but not a passcode. The law is amusing as hell, is it not?
It really is.
Amusing for sure. Has anybody played around with any of the apps that have been updated to support HealthKit? This is all in the last week or so.
This was enabled by 8.0.1 and then enabled again by 8.0.2.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I feel like I'm seeing press releases, breathless press releases about, the fitness app will now talk to the health app and keep all your data in one place. I don't know. Maybe it says something about the fact that I'm not very fitness oriented, but I have yet to find it to be a killer service for me yet. But, you know, these are early days, too.
I don't know. I haven't seen anything yet. None of the apps that I use have updated to support the health app yet. So I was just checking, and there's nothing in there.
Nothing in there,
but
huh?
I think, you know, at some point Apple said this was going to happen about a month after release when they had this kind of mess up that prevented a lot of this stuff from working. And then they released it with 8.0.1. And so I wonder if the developers are all like, come on, Apple. I'm still working on it. I don't know. Yeah. It's going to take time, like a lot of these things. It's going to take time for all the apps.
Absolutely, I feel that the same way about iOS 8, where I don't think I don't think that the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus have been officially released until December or January, when not only developers have a chance to update their stuff to work with these phones, but also that they themselves have had time with these new phones, these new technologies, that as users, they can decide, oh, I thought that academically back in August, I'd want my app to behave this way, but actually it makes more sense for it to interact like this. So it's going to be pretty exciting come January, I think.
I'm excited to use apps that can somehow take advantage of at least keeping health data in one place. But
health data
again,
HealthKit is still kind of rough. Like when you install an app that uses HealthKit, Apple's got really, really good privacy protection. So you can choose send and receive for every single function of that app. But that's leading to these page long toggle sheets that you just get presented with almost like a wall of permissions when you first start. And the developers have found bugs in some of the things and they're having trouble addressing them. And if you have multiple devices, you have to set up, like, are you going to let your Jawbone up communicate your steps? Are you going to let the chip in your phone do it? Are you going to let them know about each other? It seems like this is a technology that's still sort of coalescing, and it'll take a few months before we have really good HealthKit apps, but we also really know how to use it, and Apple sort of really understands what developers and we're doing so they can make it all work better for us.
And this also goes far beyond just fitness and mobility. If you drill down into that menu structure and see all of the fine-grained health data that this can collect and manage and organize for you. If you've ever been the caretaker for someone who is critically ill, you know that you really, there's information that you need to track on an hourly and a daily basis. And only by collecting that data over a period of days and weeks and sometimes even months do you figure out, like, if you're suddenly taking care of someone who is an insulin-dependent diabetic, this is a problem that I was having when I was taking care of my mom, where it took a couple of weeks to figure out how to manage her sugar perfectly. So if she gets a snack at exactly this time of the night, she will not have a problem. I want to make sure that I do another check at this time of day. And that was the sort of stuff that only happened because I kept an old PowerBook on the kitchen table with a spreadsheet that did nothing but collect this data that I was inputting. And so when you look at this sort of data that could be not just collected by the fact that you're walking around, but also if you imagine it as part of a house that has different health devices inside it that can now communicate with this and feed all this information saying, well, the patient, the individual was moving from these times of the day to this other time of day. Here is what their blood chemistry was like. Here is what their oxygen intake was like. That's going to be the really wonderful and beneficial part of this is going to be when you just simply take a phone out of your pocket and glance at this graph and you see correlations that you did not see before, only by virtue of the fact that this data has no one localized place to land and a really cool user interface to present itself. So certainly the features that everybody's going to be looking at and be most familiar with is how many steps did I walk? How many calories did I consume? What was my heart rate if I have a heart rate monitor? But there are going to be a small percentage of the users out there. They're going to get the greatest benefit of all because those are the people who really needed HealthKit.
Yeah, I think probably the day-to-day, how many calories did I burn? You know, the novelty of that is going to wear off for a lot of people, even if you have got good intentions, kind of like going on a diet. Most of the time, you end up losing interest, and it's not actually data that's going to work that well for you because your behaviors, you can't just change them overnight because you've got some tools.
Even that is cool, too, because I do take constitutionals 2 to 4 times a week. I don't, it's not like I spend all my time inside the house doing, getting all my exercise from the wrists downward. I tried a health band for a while. At some point you misplace where the charger is because you come home from a trip. And so it takes you 2 days to find it. And then after 2 days, you kind of got out of the habit of keeping this thing on your wrist at all times. Whereas the phone is something you always have on you, you always have with you. So it can really do a good job of monitoring your activity. And like I was saying earlier, once you have all this incidental data that's being collected where you weren't even really interested in this as a project of using data to improve my health, but you accidentally or just out of bored curiosity because your bus is late and you finished your last Kindle book, you look at this data and it can show you that, oh, well, here are the days when I just don't seem to leave the house. I don't seem to do a lot of activity. And here are days where I seem to be very, very active. I need to be more active on these days. I'll tell you one quick story about I was doing maintenance of my Google account, which is something that you should do often. Google collects a lot of information, but the good thing about the way they do it is that it's all on one page. They're very upfront. Here's all the information we've got on you. You can take a look at the data yourself. If you don't want us to collect this data, not only can you stop us from doing that, but you can also delete the data that's there. And I was only looking at some my movement data, tracking like where I happen to go with my phone, that I realized that, okay, so you left the house on Sunday. Good. You didn't leave the house Monday or Tuesday. You left the house briefly to go to the store 1 mile away on Wednesday. Didn't leave the house Thursday. Okay. You know, Andy, maybe you should just like put shoes on more often over the course. I know you're a freelancer, but this indicates something that if you correct this in your 40s, your doctor will not be suggesting surgery in your 50s, maybe.
Yeah, never thought about that. They know a lot about your how good of a sitter we are, as in sitting on the couch. bending our phones.
It takes energy to get off the couch. We should get credit for that. That barometer should say, okay, congratulations, you went from 18 inches off the ground to 43 inches
off
the ground.
That's a lot of momentum. Exactly.
The watch is going to bug you to stand up.
Yeah. It's a reverse squat. That's hard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm just pacing myself. That's all. I did.
There you go. Let's take another quick break. We want to thank Squarespace this time for sponsoring this episode of Mac Break Weekly. Squarespace.com, if you don't use it, I've been using Squarespace for years. It's an all-in-one platform. Whether you want to, once you got your hover domain, exactly, then it's like, well, now what do you want to do with it? That's where Squarespace actually comes in really well. All-in-one platform that makes it really easy and fun, actually, to create a professional website or online portfolio of some kind. If you even just go to squarespace.com, you can look through templates that they have as a jumping-off point. I'm not a designer. I wish I was. I'm just not. I never really know where to start. I don't really feel like I understand color palettes and I'm not design inclined. Squarespace has some really beautiful templates that you can just use to get started. You just go ahead and start building your website. Maybe you're pulling in data from somewhere else. But it is a really nice starting point. Really impressive. I've even had fun just kind of switching around templates to see how all of my information looks different depending on which template I've used. Once you're up and running, the designs are beautiful. And of course, they're completely customizable. You're not stuck with some template that you think, oh, this is really great, but I don't really like the placement of this one column. All of that stuff is customizable and it's easy to use. Squarespace has live chat and email support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But in many cases, this is all very intuitive. It's really designed for people who don't know that much about putting together a professional website. If you do, you're going to love it already. But if you don't, you're not going to feel like you're lost or that you're over your head. And then, of course, for those times that you might need a little bit of help, you do have that support from Squarespace as well. E-commerce is supported. All subscription plan levels now have the ability to accept donations. Hey, if you're running a nonprofit, maybe you're looking to pull in some cash for a wedding registry or some sort of a fund drive. Maybe you're raising money for the the football team at the elementary school. Whatever it might be, that's a really nice offering from Squarespace as well. Plans start at just $8 a month. That's really inexpensive considering that they do everything for you. Includes a free domain if you sign up for a year, and it's mobile ready. I'm really not actually tinkering around with Squarespace on my desktop all that often anymore, but they sure have a nice iPad app. It's great. Yeah, you go in and see who's been visiting my blog, look at some stats. You can manage comments from the mobile offerings as well. And anybody who, likes good code at Squarespace is really nice. Everything under the hood is lovely. Again, hosting is included, and you can actually start a free 2-week trial without even needing your credit card. You're not on the hook for anything. You just start building your website. 2 weeks, completely free. Try out some templates, see what you like. And when you decide to sign up for a plan at Squarespace, use the offer code MacBreak. That's MacBreak, MacBreak, and you'll get 10% off. And it also gives you opportunity to show your support for MacBreak Weekly and Twit. As a special promotion for our MacBreak Weekly audience, Squarespace is giving away a full year of its most premium level service, which is valued at more than $288, to a randomly selected audience member. Just tweet "Better Websites for All" with hashtag Squarespace MacBreak to be considered. If you currently have a Squarespace site, then post your site URL too, and we might talk about it on a future episode. Again, 2-week trial, no credit card needed. Start building your website with Squarespace. I guarantee you're going to like it. The folks at Squarespace have been very good to us over the years, and we've always really liked working with them. So thanks to Squarespace for their support of MacBreak Weekly. A better web awaits you, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. So FBI Director James Comey said last week, I think it was last Thursday, that he was pretty concerned with some steps that companies like Apple, I think the following day Google came out and said, yeah, we're going to make sure that data is encrypted so that in a new way, so that when the NSA comes knocking on our door, we can say, well, we have zero access to any of that data. So as an Apple consumer, customer, I can then feel a little bit more free to express myself if for some reason I was worried about that sort of thing. Comey told reporters at a press conference about this subject, quote, "I'm a huge believer in the rule of law, but I also believe that no one in this country is beyond the law. What concerns me about this is companies marketing something expressly to allow people to place themselves beyond the law." Okay, I believe that I can understand what Director Comey is getting at here. Clearly, he works for the FBI, so he has a vested interest in wanting as much information as possible. And let's just say that, hey, they're you know, if you think about the bureau, what they're trying to do is keep the good people safe from the bad people.
Well, I'm sure the head of the Chinese FBI and head of the Russian FBI wants the same access, the head of the Congolese FBI. I mean, America is where Apple is located, but it is not by any means the only country in the world. And
sure,
I am happy that, you know, if the FBI probably doesn't want other security agencies to have access to the information. And we live in a world where, unfortunately, if you let one person in, you're letting everybody in. So I'm much happier if all of them have to go knocking on personal doors and not some big server anymore.
Yeah, this is. I mean, you hear this from law enforcement all the time. When the Miranda decision came down that they were going to have to read people their rights, they said, "Oh God, we're never going to be able to arrest anybody ever again." Guess what? They adapted. It was fine. This is one of those examples too, where these kind of policies really hurt American companies selling their products in foreign markets, because you know, if you know that the American government holds the keys to the encryption to this product, and you're in some other country, you're like, "We can't use this product. They're going to be spying on us." So I get the overarching idea that they want to protect us, but using a backdoor, getting an encryption key, especially given how the government has been approaching these tech companies and in secret for national security reasons and trying to get them to set up backdoors for them and setting up monitoring within organizations like Apple and Yahoo and Google and Microsoft and you name them. I think that as a member of the public, I want Apple to be in my corner and say, "Look, we're not going to get between you and the government here."
Mm-hmm.
And that was where Apple was. They held those keys. And so Apple, it's like saying you could be compelled to put your thumbprint on your Touch ID scanner. Apple could be compelled to give that information up. And Apple and Google both saying, "Look, we don't want to get in this. We don't want to hold the keys to your data, to all our customers' data." I think that's fantastic. And I think that law enforcement will adapt. They always do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, I'm sure I'm not the only person in the world, certainly maybe not even the person in this conversation, who found it his choice of words very, very chilling, that the fact that I want to have a phone in which my data is secure means that I'm doing something suspicious, because he said that the only reason why you would want this is because you want to skirt the law. What is his opinions on the fact that I can go to Office Max and buy a shredder? What is his position on the fact that I've got a wood-burning stove in my house and I could burn papers? And she said, no, you're not allowed to burn anything until we've taken a look to make sure there's nothing we want to see on that. I mean, this is a very, very important principle. I mean, I don't, I've never talked to anybody at that high level of law enforcement. I have spoken to people at a lower level, and their opinion is always that we believe that it is our responsibility to use every legal option that's available to us to, as you say, keep the bad people from harming the good people. But we use as our guidance the fact that the people choose to make something illegal. It's not as though most of the law enforcement folks I've spoken to don't feel as though they have a God-given constitutional right to see everything that you do and have their thumbprint on your pulse at every moment of the day. So that's why it was very, very chilling to hear him speak of I think part of it was maybe a little bit of PR to try to poison the well of public opinion, saying that there is only one reason why you would want encrypted data on your phone, and that's because you're up to no good.
You're a terrorist.
To basically turn the public against this. Which is, if that's true, is a really terrible thing. It's also poorly timed, because just a few weeks after we learn about how people who thought that their private photos were nicely and securely stored somewhere, it was available because of password hacks and, you know, weaknesses in human engineering, not weaknesses during the system. Whereas if they had simply had encrypted storage on all their data and handled it that way, not that they were victims, excuse me, not that they're anything but victims of personal personal theft there, but this is an extra step to say, you know what, we never know where our phone is going to end up. We never know where our data is going to end up. It's just prudent with all the people who want our credit card information, that want our personal information, that even want our photos, if only for yucks. The ability to control the flow of data on our phones and the security of data on our phones is going to be a fundamental thing we want in every device, just as fundamental as a touchscreen.
And there was a police association or police chief in one of the cities who immediately played the child pornography card, which, you know, is even more disturbing and an even quicker bellwether that something pretty terrible is going on in the discussion.
Yeah, the classic line here, I gotta point out John Gruber, who, when he posted a link to a story about this on Daring Fireball, the headline he used was FBI and police departments endorse Apple's full device encryption, because the idea there is when they play the pedophile card, you know that they have run out of arguments and are just trying to scare people into taking their side because there's a bogeyman out there and scary, and missing the larger issues. And I think Gruber nailed it. So, yeah. Like I said, Miranda is the best example here. That was the end of law enforcement in the early 70s when that ruling came down, that you had to read people their rights. And guess what? Law enforcement's doing fine.
When they wanted to take everybody's fingerprints and we're told they couldn't. You know, we need everybody's fingerprints.
Everybody's DNA. Yeah.
If you go to the Spy Museum in D.C., you will see a room that's a reconstruction, or at least a few years ago, a reconstruction of, I think, was a Romanian secret police archive, in which there are mason jars filled with, like, identical pieces of white cloth, because, according to this exhibit, the secret police was systematically collecting scents from as many people as they possibly could, so that if they needed to track them down with dogs later on, they could go get the jar, get this cloth, and get this. And that's the sort of thing. And the message from that is that realize that we don't work for you. You guys work for us, so you better do what we want you to do, or else. And so that's why this is just one guy, one powerful guy making one statement. It has to be backed up by the people that he relies on for political power and funding, and also really on, as cynical as you can get, it relies on us saying that's perfectly fine, where we support you in this policy. So it's not that we're not at Armageddon yet, but it's certainly a warning that this is going to be an even more important thing, and that people who did not have encryption on their phones today are probably going to be more interested in encrypting their phones next month.
Absolutely. Speaking of different options for phones, this is kind of an interesting article that I read. Actually, great little graph that Ars Technica put up that shows competitors of the big smartphone competitors, employee counts, and that Samsung has, as far as full-time employees, this is in 2013, 275,000 and some change employees. I mean, compare that to, let's say, Google, which is, I think, by and large, thought of as a pretty big company. Just under 48,000. Samsung has, like, Googles.
They're a huge company. Like, Apple's got Apple Retail, which distort the numbers. Samsung makes oil rigs and toilets and half of
rice cookers,
half of the
and
machinery.
Fridges.
Yeah, everything.
Sure. Well, yeah, Samsung. I mean,
and processors for Apple's products.
They're talking Samsung Electronics.
In the Pixar universe, they are by and large. Their logo is on everything.
Yeah, and Apple, Renee's exactly right. Apple's number now includes all the people who work in Apple retail. I think a more telling graph would be the people who are working on, you know, the computer sector and the smartphone sector at, you know, essentially at the headquarters or doing development. And those numbers would be probably a lot smaller certainly for Apple, certainly for Samsung, and probably for all of them.
You know, speaking of retail, how do you think Microsoft's new Fifth Avenue store will do when it opens in mid-2015?
Are you going to line up there for Windows 10? Is that the plan?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I'm familiar with Fifth Avenue. Apple has a nice store on Fifth Avenue. It's kind of known as a big shopping hub. I could see.
So they're going to be like a clear plastic pyramid or octagon or something? Is that what it's going to look like?
You're not far off, Jason, because there is, like, right across the street from the Boylston Street flagship Apple store in Boston, you go into the Prudential Mall, there is a Microsoft store, and it's like the bizarro world version of Apple, where the Apple store is like deep, the Microsoft store is wide, the Genius Bar is the last thing you see in the Apple store, it's the first thing you encounter when you enter the Microsoft store. It is truly opposite day, and also opposite day in terms of how many people are actually there during the holiday season.
That's what it's like at my mall, too. It's the same thing, is that there's an Apple store that's packed, and then there's a Microsoft store that's not, and they are. It's like black is white and night is day, and it's fascinating. But, you know, this is something that happens in retail. Retail is real estate, and some people argue that Starbucks became as successful as it did because they were really good at choosing real estate. And Microsoft has done a smart shorthand because Apple was so smart at picking real estate that Microsoft looks at where Apple stores are and says, we should be there too. And that happens in retail in lots of sectors, not just the one that we care about here, which is the computer and technology
here, Jason.
Area. Yeah. Yeah. So Fifth Avenue seems like a good place to be. Let's do that.
It seems like a good place to be, but as Andy mentions, it's not necessarily, it's good to have a spot in a well-trafficked area, particularly for a holiday season, although this store isn't going to open until mid-next year sometime. But I just wonder how much, you know, the Apple Store model has worked so well for Apple over the years. But I think that's not just because it looks a certain way, but it's because, well, everything in there is Apple. Yeah, you've got some third party, you know, headphones and hard drives and that sort of thing. Yeah, really, it might change a bit. But, you know, something like Microsoft, which is all about OEMs and partners and that sort of thing, I don't know how, because clearly Microsoft would like to recreate the Apple Store experience as a Microsoft store that people want to go and hang out in and you know, that whole thing. I just don't know if it's possible. I don't know if you can do that no matter where you're putting in a store.
Because the Apple Fifth Avenue store was famous. I don't know if it's still the case, but it was famous for outperforming Tiffany's in a per square foot ratio. They were just making hand over fist money. And you have to wonder, would Microsoft operate it at a loss? Is this supposed to be a profitable business? Samsung had an experience store where you couldn't even buy stuff. You could just go in and see how the Samsung experience made you feel. And that obviously was for marketing, not for revenue generation. So you wonder, I've experienced these malls where you go in and there's an Apple store, and then across the path, there's a Microsoft store with big cutout words that you have to step awkwardly over to get into, and very thick tablets on the displays. It really is a different experience. And I don't know if it'll be a successful one on that street.
I'm a little surprised that Satya and Nadella didn't come in and rethink this. And maybe they have behind the scenes, but going ahead with a Fifth Avenue store, it seems like that Microsoft really is committed to this retail concept, and it could work. I got to be honest, I'm actually surprised when I go into or walk past a Microsoft store that there aren't more people in them, because it doesn't seem like a bad idea. It does work for Apple. I don't know quite what Microsoft is doing wrong, or if it's just that the products that they have and the brand name of Microsoft just doesn't bring people in, because it's not a bad idea to showcase your partners and the products you make yourself, like Surface and Xbox, and bring that worked really well for Apple. It's like, once people see this stuff and pick it up, they get excited about it. And the Microsoft stores, I don't know, I don't have anything but anecdotes, but all my anecdotes are that they're empty.
And it's weird, because it's not as if the Microsoft aisle at Best Buy is a place to avoid. There's something about it, when you take away, I guess, the brand variety, it becomes what am I going to
the Microsoft
store for?
Is way nicer than the aisle at Best Buy. It is. Right. I mean, we can make fun of it being not quite the Apple store and being like a bizarro version of Apple stores, but it's not a bad store. It's a nice, well laid out kind of big aisles. It's not like you're in a big box store, but they're just not. I'm a little surprised they're still doing them, I guess, is what I'm saying.
There's a weird thing, and I don't want to make it into too much of a Microsoft thing, but like, they just announced Windows 10. They're skipping Windows 9 and making Windows 10. Like, they got rid of the word Metro. I mean, there's these choices that they make in their general branding that I don't think are always they always make them appreciated by the general masses. Apple, whether you love them or hate them, their brand is iconic. They have a very clear vision for it, and that suits retail very well. Microsoft hasn't taken, like, the Xbox was terrific. If they had built something around Xbox and Windows Media Center and put it all together, Windows Phone, into a beautiful, sensible branding package, X Phone, Xbox, X Slate, maybe XOS, X Store, whatever, I think it would be much more digestible. You'd get a lot more people involved. Right now, it's there's that store for that thing that runs on that beige box at work that I don't even want to talk about right now. And I think that hurts them in the long run.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think an Xbox store, if they're okay with getting gamers in there all the time, as opposed to people who are lining up to buy $10,000 gold wristwatches, that would be a more focused idea. I mean, part of the problem for problem, quote unquote, has always been for Microsoft that their Apple is the exciting company you go to because they do exciting things and you want to walk away from the thing that you're using and use the thing that's made by Apple because it's so stylish and so focused and so well designed and it works so very well. Microsoft has always been a lot more like the company that simply provides clean drinking water to your house. They're not exciting. You might even not know what the brand is until you actually make the payment every single month, but you use their product and service every single day and they can be very, very profitable that way. The fact that it's embarrassing maybe that Windows 8 has not made quite so big a splash, but then you look at the history of OS releases. Windows XP was a big hit. They replaced it with Vista. Vista kind of tanked, so they kind of secretly rebranded it as Windows 7. They took the ideas that were working and also the infrastructure improvements that were important for Vista, and then by calling it Windows 7, now they have the sort of smash hit that they wanted. I'm not sure if this is cyclical for Microsoft, but I have no trouble believing the possibility that Windows 8 is sort of like Windows Vista, where it was the unpalatable fusion of desktop and mobile that people didn't want. Fine, that's great. We are going to take the ideas that we liked about it, the things that you were responding well to it, the things that are important for our future, and we're going to call the next thing something else entirely so that when you come back to us, you can say, you know what? Yeah, I mean, Windows 8 sucked, but now congratulations. You learned the error of your ways, and now you're doing something brand new. You're looking at I've only been able to look at the coverage of Windows 10 from afar, but you see that they're taking things like putting back the start screen, but and also taking the live tiles concept from their mobile devices and now integrating that into the start screen in a very interesting way. So it's not necessary for them to have these big flashy rollouts. All they have to do is keep the water clean, keep it furnished, and making sure the people that want clean drinking water can get access to that, and that's going to be the secret to their success.
You know, we talked about the idea of the Mac Mini finally getting a refresh, but we didn't talk about this rumor coming from 9to5Mac that might be getting Retina iMacs with, of course, OS X Yosemite. Mark Gurman over at 9to5Mac, who's, I mean, he's all about the scoops these days, says that the company's in late testing and they could launch soon. And it's interesting because, you know, when I first read this article, I was like, what kind of different Retina is it than it already has? Because I just didn't think of the fact that Apple doesn't actually have Retina displays for the desktops. They just look nice, right? You know, nice 27-inch iMac looks pretty good to me. But no, that's actually not a, you know, ultra-high definition, even though I guess Retina came to the iPhone 4 back in, is that right?
Yep.
That was a pretty big step up. So I can imagine for tired eyes, it would be pretty nice to gaze upon a Retina desktop computer as well. A lot of pixels, yeah.
So many pixels.
Some that you don't even see, not even visible to the naked eye.
As far as I know, they've been working on 4K, 5K Retina displays. They always do many prototypes and they try to figure out they have audacious prototypes and they have conservative prototypes and they try to figure out what they can do that has low enough cost, high enough yield. And there was a rumor for a while that they would go ahead, that the panels would be expensive enough that they'd put them in the cinema display first, or I think they call it the Thunderbolt display now, because it would be more likely to be bought by Mac Pro owners. And that means they wouldn't have to make as many and they could charge a higher price. But if they're going for iMacs, it means that and we've seen this in other people who make Retina or 4K displays, the prices are coming down sufficiently that they can get them into the iMac first, which is what they did with the original IPS displays. And then when those are in balance, sort of push them out into the panels. But this makes a ton of sense, and it'll happen as soon as Apple can make the numbers.
Yeah, it's so many pixels. So many pixels. Jack March, who's a pseudonym, I think, for somebody who has also some rumor sources, said the 27-inch is definitely going to happen. The question is, do they keep the old iMacs around? Do they add these at the top of the line? They did that with the MacBook Pro. Do they just add one, or do they add a bunch of them? I'm really intrigued by this. I was in the camp of never wanting to buy an iMac again and kind of go with an external monitor of my own and a Mac Mini or a Mac Pro. But I don't know. It'll be an interesting temptation for a lot of us to have a nice Retina display on a big monitor like that, it's going to cost a lot, I would imagine, but it could look really great.
Yeah, I'm keen to see what that would look like in the flesh, because it's easy to appreciate a Retina display on a phone. It's easy to appreciate it on a notebook that's about 14 inches in front of your face. When I use my desktop machine, that screen is so far away that even with my reading glasses on, I'm not sure how much I'm going to appreciate the Retina resolution, but that's something I'm really going to have to experience to figure out.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the idea that iMovie or Final Cut Pro would be able to handle high res, 4K footage, that all makes sense to me. But are we all using those programs on a daily basis? I almost never do. In fact, I'm not even really editing that many photos on my iMac these days.
I mean, I have to admit that I hear people who are certainly offering sincere and rational opinions about how, gee, after I got my Retina MacBook Pro, I can't even look at a non-Retina laptop display anymore without wanting to vomit. but I, on a daily basis, I'm switching between my Retina MacBook Pro and my old non-Retina MacBook Pro, and I certainly appreciate the difference. But usually, when I'm editing a photo in aperture, when I'm actually just doing a day's work with it, I'm aware of the difference, but I'm not. If you offered me $500 if a non-Retina version were $500 less based on this experience, I wouldn't necessarily be spending the extra $500 for Retina. It's just not that big of a deal for me.
Yeah, I mean, do we? What
I would love.
What happens to that desktop computer in the corner of the office? I mean, it's. How much do we actually need something like the Retina display? Of course, like you mentioned, Andy, it's going to look great. But how much of your daily process depends on that? Jason, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. They look great. I appreciate it when I use one. Mm-hmm. I've used a Retina MacBook Pro, but only briefly. For a day or two here and there. And I don't know. It looks great. It's easier to read the text on the screen. I do a lot of reading of text on screens. It's not as huge a deal as it is on a phone or even a tablet. Andy is absolutely right. But it's going to be beautiful, and it is where we're going, right? So the question, it's going to be early adopter technology just like everything else. You're going to pay through the nose to do it at the beginning, and then in the middle somewhere it'll start to make sense, and then a few years later everybody will have it and we will have forgotten that we used to be able to see the pixels. And we're at the very start of that now, where the people who are going to buy, let's say this happens, a Retina iMac, they're going to do it because they really want to be there on the cutting edge and they love it. But it's inevitable, right? 3 or 4 years from now, every display on every Apple product will be Retina.
Sure.
Addie, what are pixels?
And as well, when a sub-pixel and a mommy pixel love each other very much, they get into a pixel cluster. You're right. And also, Apple, I think more often than not, their usual strategy is to keep the price of a product the same, but improve it with better components as years go by. And so if the price of a 27 or even a smaller sized iMac is going to be the same 3 years from now, and it still has a Retina display, great. Well, it has a Retina display. I wish that if we had the option of saying, well, if you value Retina, we can charge you $500 more for this. But if you're perfectly fine with what you have, we'll make this more affordable and more accessible to you. But who knows?
iPhone 6 and 6 Plus models will be available in China. Apple has announced starting Friday, October 17th. Pre-orders begin Friday, October 10th, the week prior. Interesting story that I read about yesterday that the gray market, as they call it, for iPhones, like, say you buy a bunch of iPhones in Hong Kong and then get them to third-party vendors in Beijing, for example, what's the premium? What do they go for people who don't want to wait, certainly? And that the gray market value of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus has plummeted from what would, the equivalent would be something like, I think that, the top of the line for the 6 Plus was equivalent to about $2,500. That has dropped now to something like the equivalent of $2,000. So it's still certainly a markup, but I wonder how much that really, that's actually spells. What does it mean for the somebody who wants to go through the proper channels of just buying a phone when it's legally available in your country versus the kind of person who will pay almost anything, no matter what it costs, to be first? I'm not sure that falling prices in a gray market is really mirroring the actual market. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm crazy. Do we think that the 6 and the 6 Plus are going to make a killing in China? I mean, they're on, Apple's has a partnership with China Mobile now. That was always something that it used as an excuse to say, well, if we were on China's largest carrier, then we'd be selling more phones. I don't know. I don't get the impression that somehow it's going to be a flop in China, but what does everyone else think?
The gray market is all about people who want it and will pay to get it before they can otherwise get it, right? So now it's going to be out in China, what, October 17th,
mm-hmm.
right? Yep. And so the gray market there is going to dry up because people are going to say, oh, well, I can wait that long. That's not that long. But there will be other parts of the gray market too. I mean, I went to Bermuda a few years ago on one of these Mac cruises, which was pretty cool. But they're in the Latin American region, and the people in Bermuda are largely British. And we're really frustrated by the fact that the Latin American region was like the last place that got all the new Apple gear. And so they had an off-brand Apple store that was filled yep. with gray market products where people were like literally bringing them back from their trips to London and New York. They'd say, you know, go get a couple more iPads, go get a couple more laptops and just bring them back. And those markets will always exist. It's a little bit like the market for upgrades where they take off the back plate of the phone and replace it with a solid gold back plate. I mean, there's a market that will pay and they want it now. And, you know, I think that, you know, that continues. It's just that China will no longer be the 800-pound gorilla of gray markets now that the phone got approved.
Yeah. And I keep remembering that my time in Beijing a few years ago. And of course, one of the first tourist spots I wanted to go to was show me the shopping mall that has nothing but counterfeit merchandise. Cause I want to buy, I want to look at it and maybe buy a counterfeit iPhone. And it's true that you could buy iPhones that this is before the iPhone was formally introduced into China. And they're perfect. Absolutely pitch perfect, and even when you light it up, pixel perfect copies of the iPhones for the most part. But you will also see a flip phone, like with an illuminated Apple logo on the back of it, and it's called the iPone, I-P-O-N-E. And immediately you're thinking, oh, wow, that's stupid. It doesn't even look like an iPhone. And then you realize that, no, the most important thing is that it has a big Apple logo that's illuminated so people can see the Apple logo. So a lot of it is just going, is still going to be that brand. That even if the not legitimate market dries up, it will still be very, very important. So, well, this is a very exclusive, very cool, like international brand that I have. Just like people don't even care that you don't know that you know that your Hermes bag or whatever is a knockoff. You like being associated with that cool logo that you've seen the fancy schmancy people on the cover of the National Enquirer using.
It's not new. When I was a kid and I went to Hong Kong, you'd go buy your jeans in one store and then go pick the label you wanted before you finished your purchase. It's just
really
it's about, yeah.
Wow.
It's entirely about brand and perception and image, and it's incredibly involved, a little bit convoluted from the outside, but the iPhone is just the latest sort of cultural icon that's either benefiting or being mauled by that, depending on how you look at it.
I saw a great image on Twitter last week that was one of those little Apple iPhone power adapters from the US, the little tiny ones, and it was a photo of the labeling on the back of it, which said designed in California by Agle. Seems legit to me.
Oh, Agle.
Yeah, Agle. 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 I think it was Agle Japan. Yeah. It was very clearly somebody who, and it had a SENAL number, S-E-N-A-L number. It was very clearly somebody who wasn't really strong with the Roman character set. And it was pretty funny. This is a show about Agle, right? Right? We're talking all about.
Yeah.
And we're here in California, so it seems legit to me.
Agle. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what that means. Should we take one last break before we get to our tips of the week from everybody? I think that now is as good a time as any. This is actually a relatively new sponsor, at least for me. This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Casper, revolutionizing the mattress industry. Actually got a mattress, a couple years ago, because the one that I had been sleeping on for many years physically hurt me and I was hurting myself, but it was very expensive, the new mattress that I got. It was kind of one of these impulse purchases because I wanted to buy it off the internet and I felt like, well, I'll just pick a brand, right, that has good brand recognition and hope for the best. Wish I would have known about Casper when I did that. Casper is slashing the cost of what a typical mattress would go for, $1,500 and up from there. They are not cheap because they cut out resellers. They cut out showrooms, which I don't know about you, but I do not want to go to a mattress showroom. That is just not even fun. That's like a terrible night out on the town. And then they pass the savings directly on to you as an online consumer. We love buying things online, but it's difficult when you need a mattress is one of the most personal purchases you're ever going to have. Casper is a comfortable mattress. It gives you a great night's sleep. It's just the right combination of premium latex and memory foam technologies. So it gives, and it's got some bounce. And, you know, if you roll over, your partner's not going to wake up in the middle of the night because it is designed for comfort for everybody that's involved. Casper Mattress provides long-lasting comfort and support. Leo's got a Casper mattress, has said a lot of nice things about it. Soft, comfortable. And again, you can buy it easily online and it's risk-free. Casper offers free delivery. And if, hey, you need to return it, it's not the right mattress for you, that is a painless process as well. You have 100 days. So that's a lot of sleeping before you say, I should have maybe gone with something that was a little firmer or something different. So you really have a lot of time to try it out before you decide, okay, this is the mattress for me. 100 whole days. You don't ever have to go to a showroom and lie down on some mattress that who knows who else has been on them. Sorry, I haven't seen this video of Leo before writhing around on his mattress. I like how he's wearing all white, too. That's a really nice touch. Look at him.
It's like he's in like a 1991 music video.
Really? Yeah, exactly. There should be a Billy Idol needs to walk around the corner at some point. And yeah, this is he said a lot of really nice things about his Casper mattress. Hopefully I can get one as well. And statistically, lying on a bed in a showroom really doesn't give you much of a sense of how it's actually going to be when you sleep in it at night. You know, the lights are on, you're wearing all your clothes, you're not in your bedroom. It's tough, even in person, to get the best mattress. So Casper passes the savings along to you. The mattresses are made in the USA. It's a great process overall. You can get a Casper mattress, $500 for a twin, $950 for a king, which is a great price versus the sort of showroom mattresses and those prices that you might be used to because they are marked quite a bit up more. If you go to Casper Sleep, that's CISPER sleep.com/MacBreak, and then you enter the promo code MacBreak, you can save $50, 50 bones, 50 bucks for you at CasperSleep.com/MacBreak. And that promo code, again, is MacBreak, all one word. For every mattress purchased through this show, by the way, Casper will donate $50 to Child's Play, which is a great foundation at all. You can refer a friend, and they can get $50 off their mattress, too. Mattresses for everybody. And so you get a $50 retail gift card. There's a limit of 10 referral redemptions per customer on that. But a lot of good stuff. A lot of good stuff going on with our friends at Casper. And we thank them for sponsoring this episode of Mac Break Weekly. All right, Andy, do you want to kick off with your pick of the week?
Sure. A couple of weeks ago, when I was first talking about the coming iPhone 6 Plus, I was excited about having like a pocketable keyboard and like writing solution because it was such a nice big screen. And a listener, I talked about the stowaway keyboard that a company called Think Outside used to make for the previous generation of PDAs and Blackberries and Trios about 10 years ago. I'm looking for something like that. And actually, a listener, let me use CraneCam 3000, the future of video podcasting. This is an actual stowaway keyboard that a listener happened to have rattling around in his office and was nice enough to send me. And you see this compared to the size of the iPhone 6, and you can understand why this is such a really desirable thing. I also encountered, however, a company called Lapworks that has this keyboard. Now, again, here's the original vintage one, and here is the Lapworks version of this folding keyboard. They call it the Amigo, and let me show you why I was so excited about it. It's about this size, but then you do this, and then you do this, and now you have a full laptop-sized keyboard.
That's a transformer.
Exactly. It's brilliant. It hooks up via Bluetooth. It comes with a little, tiny little OEM stand like this. And so you put your iPhone or iPad or whatever on this. Of course, not just for the iPhone, but it's for anything else. And when you're done with it, you just simply do this, do that, do this. And you have to be a little bit careful with it. And then it comes back in this tiny little easily digestible package. And there is your writing kit for the entire day. I've had this for about a week. I've been typing with it. You can actually get real good touch type on it. So I'm very, very pleased with it. And it seems to be absolutely identical to this vintage one, only you don't have the, you know, the pocket PC and Palm OS keyboard shortcuts on it. And it's really, really wonderful stuff. There are only two drawbacks to it. Number one, this is a rechargeable Bluetooth keyboard, which is good, but it uses, I don't know if you can see it, a very, very oddball, like old-fashioned style USB connector for charging. So you're going to have to make sure you don't lose track of the charging cable that it comes with, because if you lose it, you can find another one online, but you're not going to find it as easily as you're going to be able to find a micro USB cable. The second thing is that as you fold it and unfold it, it's possible, and before you get it broken in, that this is going to have a little bit of flex left into it. And so it might like bend a little bit as you type it. But it settles down the more you use it. You can see me typing on this right now, or fake typing upside down on it right now. And it's perfectly comfortable to type on, even if it does have a little bit of a flex in it when you first use it. I usually have a screen cleaning cloth that's in my kit. If you put any kind of a cloth underneath it, that's just enough to dampen that and make it perfectly typable. There is a third possible drawback to this, in that this is not cheap. It goes for $140. But if there is another keyboard that does what this does and makes as beautiful a typing experience in such a small package, I haven't found it yet. There's a company called making a keyboard called Giorno that was funded on Kickstarter about a year and a half ago. As many Kickstarter hardware projects go, they have blown through shipping deadlines as they, you know, take this idea that they had for a keyboard and try to make it into a shipping product. And so now they're promising delivery in October. Who knows? If they do ship, it'll be $79. It might be interesting to check out. But for now, if you really want that kind of ultra portability, whether you've got, you know, an iPhone 5S or if you're just using an iPad mini, boy, there is nothing like this. And this is exactly what I was sort of looking for. So
I love it.
140,
which is, yeah, if you look at Lapworks website, that's apparently the sale price. The price is normally $150. That's pretty steep. But again, if it's a better experience on something that you're going to be typing with and you like being mobile and like connecting it to various devices, it certainly does seem nice. And it folds up.
Unfolding
it and folding back up is part of the fun.
It's almost magical the way it works. And like I'm saying, I mean, this may not be for everybody, but a lot of people really do like to travel with minimal loadout and stuff.
Sure.
And if you think about going on vacation and you don't want to take a laptop, well, how about just take your iPad mini and take this, and now you're good. And you can put this in just the little day bag that you use to walk around town in. For me, I've always had this dream of either being so incredibly wealthy that I can simply board an airplane carrying nothing but the clothes on my back and just buy what I need when I get there and then throw it all away when I board the plane home, or having equipment that's small enough that I can actually board with just the tiny, tiny little bags. And this is a good step towards that. Again, not cheap, but if that's what your goal is and you travel enough like that, then it might even be worth it.
Or you're in a situation where it doesn't make sense to have a whole laptop. I mean, I'm probably the only person who spends 4 hours at a time at the hair salon, but that actually happened last Friday and I had work to do. And so what ends up happening is there's a lot of cutting and pasting on my iPad because that's really the only thing that's comfortable enough to have kind of it in my lap. But it sucks. That's not ideal at all. The laptop was just a little bit too much. The hairdresser would have been annoyed. So if I had something like this, it would have been the perfect situation.
Yeah. One last note, though, now that you bring it up. Of course, it has a folding hinge in the middle of it, so you have to have it on a flat, stable surface in order to use it. If you try to just bridge it across your lap, it will just simply collapse like a poorly constructed bridge. So do you need a hard surface in order for it to work? That's the only qualm about it.
All right. Lapworks Amigo Folding Keyboard, $140. It might be the perfect accessory for you. Renee Ritchie, what is your pick of the week?
One of the things, like Andy, that I've been most excited about with iOS 8 is the manual camera controls. And when you combine those with the iPhone 6 or the iPhone 6 Plus, it is a magical, magical new world. And there are a lot of interesting ones. For example, there's Manual, which is a very simple camera app. But there's also Camera Plus, which is the app spearheaded by Lisa Bettany that has integrated all of these controls into their already jam-packed app. And you have to go and enable them. By default, they're not enabled. But if you go into the settings and you turn on Advanced, and you can turn on exposure priority, or you can go full on manual, and then you get these controls, and you can leave it on manual if that's what you're used to, but you can also press the focus button and manually shift focus if you want to put something. iOS has got these really good algorithms for determining optimal focus, optimal exposure, optimal white balance, but you can override them. So you can have an object that's close and would be the logical choice to focus on and just say, no, I want that blurry. I want to focus on the small dude in the background. Or the color tint. For example, if you're in mixed lighting, you can change the temperature or the tint controls. You can bias exposure. So you can go between -8 and +8. So you can just, and Andy mentioned this last week really well. If the camera's telling you it wants to do a certain ISO, but you're like, no, it's too grainy. I know it's going to be dark. You can push it. You can force it to go a little bit up. Or you can go complete exposure control with ISO and the shutter speed. And just you can set it up exactly the way you want it. You can take long exposures. It makes the iPhone really a first class like mobile photography citizen. And all the stuff that I was jealous that I could do on Windows Phone that I couldn't do on iOS, you still can't do that in the iOS camera app. You can bias exposure now in the iOS camera app. But if you get one of these great third party apps like Camera Plus, it's just a playground.
Camera Plus has a lot of competition now, obviously. But yes. when Tap first released Camera Plus, and yeah, Lisa Bettany has done lots of really great demonstrations here on Twit on a variety of different shows. But it was like, oh, I mean, it was the best thing since sliced bread. Now I have like 14 other apps that are kind of like Camera Plus, or try to be anyway. But it really was the first app that helped you create photos that you have the power to do that, but the native camera app in iOS has always been a little feature not feature rich enough.
Well, it's designed so that most people most of the time can just tap it and get a good enough photo. But Camera Plus might be too much for you because, like I said, it's jam-packed. And there's apps like Manual, which is really simple. All it does is expose those manual camera controls and let you play around with them. And you can actually teach yourself how all this stuff works if you're not already familiar with it. But you combine things like there's photo pixels in the iPhone 6 and 7. So it's lightning. It's so fast to focus that you don't even see the little square of focus magic anymore. But turning all that off and letting you play around with what if I move this here or move this here, it just lets you start to understand the process really nicely.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing that I love the cameras on the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, but the only things I don't like about it is that I think the interface is way, way too cluttered. It is so hard to... I hate the fact that the button for filter effects has the exact same prominence as the actual shutter button. I think that's kind of nuts. I was accidentally activating this mode like time and time again because of the size of this phone. I hate the fact that it actually, I want to compare my experience to other people's. It took me until 2 days ago to find out that to switch between modes, you can actually swipe between any place on the viewer screen to do it. You don't have to just do it here.
Oh, how annoying.
That's new with iOS 8. iOS 7.
Because I would have been very embarrassed with myself if that were true. And even so, I've been using this for a week and a half and I didn't discover that, possibly because I've been using the iOS 7 version of it. I mean, this is, there's a lot of stuff that's really, really annoying about this app. And that's why I think this is such a huge opportunity for apps like Camera Plus. I did have that. I saw that you'd already picked it because if not, I would definitely have chosen it myself. And I mean, just the ability to do something as simple as I've got it in a manual mode right now. You tap the settings and you simply scroll to get the setting that you actually want. Because if you're chasing your kid around the living room, you don't care if it's grainy. You just want, please select. I'm going to select 1/750th of a second because I want frozen motion. I don't want this blonde 3-foot blur in this picture. And you know, the ability to override all this stuff is such a big deal, and it's just made this app so much more valuable. I've downloaded 3 or 4 different manual exposure apps, and the clarity of this interface and the simplicity of this big honking button for the shutter is what made me a really big fan of it.
Jason Snell, what is your pick of the week?
It's going to sound really boring because it's pCalc, which is a calculator app. And you're saying to yourself, wait, there's a calculator app in iOS. Why should I even bother buying a $10 calculator app?
Yeah, what do you need a third-party calculator for?
So the guy who does pCalc, James Thompson, has been working on it for, I think, almost 20 years now. He's been doing this. It was a Mac app, and now it's an iOS app. And it's got some great iOS 8 features. It will put a calculator in your notification screen. So you can just flip down and calculate something and flip it back up.
Ooh,
Apple's
nice.
Calculator won't do that. And the big new feature, I mean, it's got every nerdy calculator feature you would want, but the new feature in the latest version is you can have customizable layouts. So I've seen a lot of people creating like tip calculators and creating currency converters and creating unit converters where, you know, the buttons can on the layouts can be anything you want them to be. You can set up macros if there are particular calculations you do on a regular basis and assign it to a button and name the button and do all of that. So if you're somebody who finds yourself doing calculations a lot, you can do a whole lot better than the stock Apple calculator. And you should check out pCalc.
pCalc. $10 on the App Store, I believe.
$10 on the App Store.
Yep. You know, it's kind of like you mentioned, well, why would you want a calculator? You've already got a stock calculator. I mean, you could say the same thing for weather apps. I mean, I happen to like an app called Dark Sky. I'm sure you've talked about it here on Mac Break Weekly. And so, you know, it just gives you more options. Number crunching is,
exactly.
Know.
And if you... Go ahead, Renee.
I was going to say, like, I love this app, too. To Jason's point, I can just pick up my phone now on the lock screen, pull down Notification Center, tap in a few things, get a quick calculation, throw it back up, and be on my way. It's so nice to have it there.
Yeah.
pCalc for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. Again, $10 in the U.S. store apparently does vary slightly where it's available in other countries.
All those App Store prices vary randomly based on
You can
country.
Use pCalc to normalize them.
You can.
Exactly. Universal app, though. One app for all your iDevices. Well,
on the iPad, it's a full-size calculator in Notification Center. It's amazing.
That's so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is so cool. Why Apple wouldn't offer that?
They do on Yosemite, but not on iOS yet.
The Notification Center could be so much better if we just had more of that inline information. Again, someone at Apple is probably like, oh yeah, should have done that. We should do that in the next version of iOS 8 that we're rolling out next April or whatever.
I'm looking forward to more apps that are doing more stuff with the Notification Center because that's the stuff that when I switch between iOS and Android on a daily basis, the one thing I miss is the ability to pull down from the top of the screen, just I want to start playback or stop playback, or I want to get one thing little done that's projected into that Notification Center from the app and then flick it back up again. And that's such a handy thing. I'm so glad it's coming to iOS 8.
Well, I believe we've come to the end of a wonderful episode of Mac Break Weekly. If you joined us later in the show, Leo Laporte is on vacation this week, so everyone was kind enough to allow me to hang out with them for the last, almost 110 minutes or so. It's been a lot of fun. Of course, I was joined by Andy Anatko, Jason Snell, and Renee Ritchie going from left to right. Andy, anything you want to plug? Anything cool going on in the next week or so until we do this again?
I'm backed up on high priority reviews right now. The Moto X review, the Moto 360 review, now that I've got a handle on the battery issue, that's shipping soon. I'm definitely doing my camera part of the review of the iPhone 6. That'll hit Wednesday or Thursday, depending on when it comes out of editing, and then my full review on Monday.
Excellent. Jason Snell, in-house as a guest.
Yes,
Which is always, good to have you. Writing, podcasting, sixcolors.com.
Sixcolors.com for the writing. For the tech podcasting, go to relay.fm and look for Upgrade and Clockwise. And for pop culture podcasting, go to theincomparable.com.
Excellent. And of course, Renee Ritchie of iMore and also Podcaster Extraordinaire, which, by the way, is kind of fun because today is National Podcasting Day. Worldwide?
We had the immense pleasure of having Don Melton, who used to run Safari and WebKit at Apple, and Nitin Ganatra, who was responsible for all the iOS apps at Apple until a few years ago, on a podcast together last week. And they had a lot of wine and told a lot of really, really good stories. So if you go to imore.com/debug, you can hear what it's like when your demo for Steve Jobs goes horribly, horribly wrong, why they did indeed sometimes turn buttons off before giving him phones, the discussions around gestures on the iPhone and how many were too many and what they could do, and also things like skeuomorphism and why they were important in teaching people how to use devices. It's really, I thought it was fascinating.
It sounds fascinating to me too. Yeah, definitely check that out if you haven't listened to it already. We shoot the show, MacBreak Weekly, live on Tuesdays. If you want to join the show live, it's always a lot of fun. Usually Leo sitting here and I'm sometimes in my car driving up here listening to all of you talk. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time, thereabouts. Today, for all the live viewers, we do have an interesting day because we're followed by Windows Weekly right after this, correct? Yes, I'm right about that. So Windows Weekly and security now shifted places. I know a lot of you in IRC chat are well aware of this and anxiously awaiting talking about another exciting operating, a couple operating systems once we're done here. Of course, you can go to twit.tv/MBW to keep up on the show on demand. Subscribe to the show. We got audio and video versions of MacBreak Weekly. If you ever miss any Apple Hangover, tap the Old Spice guy. I love the titles that you guys have for the show. But yes, never miss a MacBreak Weekly again. Everything Apple, everything Mac, everything iOS. It's just pretty much a good time. Thanks everybody for watching and listening. This episode of MacBreak Weekly, episode 422, is over, and so is break time. So get back to work.
Well done.
Please. Woo-hoo. Thank you.
Well, Canadian, Sarah. Canadian.